This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 360 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and joining me from just up the road at Caves Beach on the New South Wales Central Coast, Doug Coleman. Welcome to Shutters Inc.
Oh, thanks, Bruce. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, for the listeners who don't know, Doug is a good mate with Richard Bartlett, who I had on the podcast, maybe 4 or 5 months ago now. This pair get up to lots of mischief together, and I thought it would be equally opportunistic to get Doug on for a bit of a chat. Doug's a colourful character and a similarly amazing photographer. So without blowing any more smoke up your butt, tell us your story, Doug.
Yeah, well, I'll just wait for the smoke to just dissipate. Look, you're right. I am good mates with Rich, and we came together, I suppose, through a mutual interest of photography. And I was a bit of a loose cannon, and I thought, well, why shouldn't I share it? So I do quite a few road trips and work with Rich a fair bit.
So how long have you had a camera in your hand?
Oh, look, do we go back to when, I was an eight-year-old and saved up for an Instamatic, I think it was a 124 Instamatic Kodak with the cube.
Flashes.
Yeah, so look, I always wanted to take a decent photo. I'm not quite sure whether I can still, but I was a bit of a happy snapper and look, even from a work perspective, I was a water police diver. The camera got a bit of a work out there, but the subjects that were photographing, they're not the type of things that you'd want to publish. So I like to photograph people that are usually breathing. So it's much more of a challenge. But then again, sometimes I get some people that I think maybe it might be better the other way. But so when I left water police, I came back to work in the construction industry, and of course I picked up the camera again, and magazines and web pages were chasing photographs, so I started photographing machines, which is really pretty boring, except to the people that work them and own them. And
what sort of machines are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking about construction, road construction.
Okay. Yeah.
Any
cool
particular vibrating road rollers. Actually, our business, we've got the largest vibrators in the world, all 28 ton of them, and I had to go out and photograph them.
Right.
Bit by bit, magazines were chasing the photos, and next minute I've got a front cover, and we all know what that's like. To get published, it's like, ooh.
Well, some of you might know what that's like.
the first cover was with a 2.3 megapixel, a Ricoh, point and shoot.
Wow.
And I thought, that gave me the drive. So, and then I thought, wow, this is pretty boring, you set the machine up, you take the photo, and it's like, it's not as if you can direct it and say, look, can you just move that tire here? Can you just, can you just... The rear view mirror, can you just drop that a bit and we'll just put the light in? It's pretty easy and it's mind numbing.
Yeah.
So the natural progression was to shoot people because I like people. So therefore that's the direction I took. So it was as early as 2008 I got my first DSLR, which was the Canon 40D.
Yep.
And that's what I started with. And I was very fortunate. I enrolled in a few classes with Warren Marshall. Yeah, it just went from there, just the techniques that I learned. Because let's face it, when you get a DSLR, it's rather daunting. It's like a different language. What are all these dials? What do these things do?
So am I correct in assuming that you didn't shoot SLR in the film days? You were just point and shoot?
Mainly point and shoot in the film days, yeah. Yeah, look, right. My dad had DSLRs, not DSLRs.
He had SLRs, yep.
Yeah, the Praktika and Yashicas and all that. And as much as that I may have pressed a button here and there, I really didn't know what I was doing. And to that point, I most probably still don't. I'm not that technical. I'm what you would call a button presser.
I'm not buying that for a minute.
Well, that's what I'm telling you. Yeah, look, you know, it's one of those fascinating things. It's not only learning the camera craft, but it's just learning your camera and knowing it intimately to get the best out of it. It's such a fascinating thing, photography.
Yeah.
And it, the thing that constantly amazes me, and you touched on it with Richard, I will go away with Richard and we will be basically standing in the same spot shooting, and we will come up with something completely different.
Yeah.
And that's what I find amazing. It's the way we view things and the way we want to portray them. And you know, I suppose all our biases and experience all roll into that. And that's our end product.
Yeah, right. So you and Richard seem to do a few road trips together. And obviously when he's busy with other things, you go off and do road trips all by yourself. What's driven, if you'll pardon the pun, the motivation to do so many road trips?
Well, I think it's a rather cathartic experience to head off with no time frame and just the object is to hopefully come back with an image, to take that wrong turn, to go down the road that you drive past, not knowing what to expect and coming back with something. And I think you have a small taste of it, and then you want a bigger taste of it. So, you know, my last trip, I was 2 months away.
Wow.
You know, I went across the Nullarbor and went to some pretty remote locations and then all the way up to Broome.
Wow.
Actually, past Broome to One Arm Point, Cape Levique. So, yeah, that was a pretty interesting trip.
And did you seriously not have a definite path in mind? You were quite happy to just take a random turn because it grabbed your attention?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
There was intention. My daughter lives in Perth. And
sure.
So that was the intention. But, you know, once you're there, you don't want to cramp their style. You want to get moving and going. And the purpose, you know, is to get out there and try and get the images. The problem is with me, you know, I'm a frustrated landscaper, you know, and as much as I love it and it gives you a bit of a balance to model photography, which is, I suppose, my forte,
yeah.
I just want to genuinely get better. I think there's nothing better than getting up in the dark, especially in a place that you've driven into in the dark. You don't know what to expect, but you set your clock. You're getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning or whatever. It's dark. So you have no idea of composition. You don't even know what's in front of you. You can hear the ocean, and then as it's getting lighter, you're scrambling for a composition. You're driving, and you're running out of time, so you've got to think quick. But the rewards are tremendous if you do succeed. And look, I managed to get lucky on a few occasions, but the problem with landscaping, you know, the old golden hour, you know, in the morning and in the afternoon, that's a lot of time to fill. A man can only drink so much coffee. And usually while you're drinking coffee, your barista's looking like she could pull a look, you know, in one of these fabulous landscapes. So I'm always never backwards in coming forwards and asking. And so I ended up getting a few shoots over there like that, girls that had never shot before. And yeah, it's
right. So some of the models that I've seen you shooting with are just people that you've met on your travels.
Absolutely. Look, when I was in Broome, and look, WA is such a small place, as you'd know.
Yeah.
There were places that I'd never been to, and you know, I drove into towns, and I bumped into people that I hadn't seen for 15, 20 years, and it was just remarkable. And I got to Broome and shot a sunset next day. I thought, you know what, while I'm here, the scenery is that spectacular. I'm going to try and do a model shoot here, but I need obviously somebody to shoot. So I bucked up the courage and looked at a store that would most probably sell clothing and beachwear and stuff like that, and I walked in.
Yep.
And these two women looked at me as if to say, my goodness, you've taken a wrong turn here, or we really don't have your size and we cater for all different people. So I made it quite clear. I said, look, you most probably don't have my size, but look, I'm a photographer and I was just wondering. And we started talking and they're looking at me sideways going, who is this creep?
Yeah.
So I produced my business card and one of the girls looked at it. And she looked at me and she said, are you Dougie Coleman? And I said, yeah, why? She said, oh, I'm Shane Larson's wife. I've seen your work, and there's a girl here coming in about 10 minutes. She's really tall, and I think she'd like to shoot.
Yeah, right.
And that's how it happened. So,
wow.
You know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So here we are shooting in 38 degrees in Broome, and it was a hard gig. You know, but, you know, I love those adventures. You just don't know which.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's a bit of a Tom Hanks moment.
Yeah. So with your modelling stuff, do you predominantly shoot natural light or do you work with modifiers or a bit of both or what?
Look, I'll work with anything. Look, my light is light.
Sure.
So I do tend to use a lot of flash. Yep. I will use a lot of flash, and I don't mind going into the middle of the day and shooting and getting those, you know, lovely blue skies that landscapers hate, and putting a person in there and just, you know, filling with a bit of flash.
Yep.
But alternatively, I always look for natural light or any light situations. I mean, you know as well as I do as a photographer, we look at things differently. We walk into a restaurant and we look at the way the person we're talking to and, you know, we might say, can you just turn just a little more to the left? Chin up a bit. Yeah, beautiful light that. Geez, I could do a shoot here. So I think it's just inherent in us. You know, we just pick it up and run with it.
And do you – I'm interested because I've seen the work that you do and I've loved everything I've seen. I'm interested to know what your approach is to metering. When you're combining flash in the middle of the day, are you going, you know, bang on for the ambient light and half a stop below for the flash, or are you the other way around, or are you evenly balanced on both? What's your approach there?
Okay, I look at what the ambient light is giving me, and I most probably go to one or two stops down, and then I'll set up my flash.
So that'll give you your rich blue skies.
Correct. Yes. Yep. So, and I think that's what I personally like. I like to just pull that down a bit. I like the moodiness, and so that's how I set up. So,
and are you setting your flash to be bang on or a half under or?
I normally try and push to the right a little on the histogram.
Yep.
I just find that obviously working in RAW, you've got more latitude. Yeah, that's predominantly the way I set up my flash. And to be quite honest, I do not look, if I'm sometimes, depending on how triggered it is, I might go to the mid-tones on the model's face and work from there. But 9 times out of 10, I suppose like a lot of photographers, you can go out in the midday and you can go, okay, F16.
What's this model's face that you're talking about? Most of the time I see, you're showing their butts.
Either that or mine. I don't do a lot of mood shoots, but I do promise the models that I will keep my clothes on. I always look for mid-tones on the face, and that's where I work from. And once you've got the exposure right, then you can play with everything else. But you know what? These days, I'll just go out there and you can pretty well guess where your settings are going to be, and within one or two shots, you're there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't use a light meter, I haven't got anything against them. I just don't know how to use them.
I've got one and I've used it once.
Yeah, look. Like a lot of things, photography can gobble up quite a lot of money, and a lot of little things can make your life easier. And what I found is sometimes they may, but you end up carting a lot of crap around, and it just takes so much time. You know, you can be in there shooting.
Yeah. Which brings me to my next question. With the sorts of stuff that I've seen you do out there on the Nullarbor and up on Cable Beach at Broome, are you modifying your flash or are you just shooting bare flash?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Look, I...
Absolutely which?
Yeah, I do. I use modifiers, right. And I swap it up a bit. Yeah, I'm using B1 Pro Photos and usually a single light. A lot of those images that you saw, yep. I carry a collapsible silver
reflector
beauty dish.
Oh, and beauty also, dish, right.
Yeah, it's a neat little thing, packs down, it's great for travelling, and I've also got a softbox version of it. But my main weapon is what's called a Magnum, and it's an open reflector, and it gives about 1 to 2 stops more light. It really punches it out, and it's harsh light, and I suppose you can see that in my images. It really pops, and there's a bit of a dramatic fall off, but with Profoto, the modifiers, by pulling the modifier backwards or forwards, you can shape the light, and that's one of the advantages of the Profoto.
Right. So, what is the, when you say a reflected, you're talking about these $70 collapsible things that just unfold and you hold them in place, or are we talking something else?
No. Collapsible modifiers actually that go on the head. So, you know, with the Profoto mount.
So what shape is this reflector that you're talking about?
They're like an Octobox.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think Profoto call them the OCF series.
Right.
So that's what I've been using predominantly, 3 of those.
3 of them?
Well, I carry the 3 depending on the lighting situation.
Yeah, right.
Midday sun, I find the Magnum punches out a lot more light. If I use the softbox, you know, that's most probably about 3 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon or early morning, you know, when the sun's not quite as bright. Right. And I'll, a soft light, depending on what I'm shooting, of course, you know.
Yeah.
Depending on what look I want.
Yeah, right.
But, so that's what I use mainly. But it's the ease of use. I just find the Profoto gear, it just, you know, within 5 minutes you can be shooting. A couple of those shots are going across the nullarbor. It was about between 7 to 11 degrees, and there was a wind chill factor on that, so you can understand the poor model. So we would be driving along and go, hey, there we go, look at that, and she'd be getting changed as I was setting up, you know, and within 20 minutes we'd be packed up and we've most probably banged off about 50 shots.
Nice.
It was a stun and run type shoot. Yeah. Think on your feet and go. The worst part about that is, you know, in a harsh environment, it'd be nice to have a bit more time because, as anybody knows, you load the photos up. Yeah, that's part of the exciting part on your computer, and you go, oh, my goodness, I wish I could have worked that angle a bit more.
Yeah.
If only I wasn't as rushed. That's a disadvantage. But when you've got limited time, you take what you can get. But, yeah, I found that just absolutely fantastic, you know, shooting different remote places. It was always a dream of mine to do that, and then to have a model say, hey, look, I've got plenty of holidays, I'll fly over. Let's fly back, which was fantastic.
Yeah. Talk about living the dream.
Oh, somebody's got to do it, Bruce.
Exactly.
And I wasn't going to shoot Richard, and there was only one place available. Yeah, so there you go. He missed out.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, we'll most probably plan something again this year somewhere in New South Wales.
Yeah, because I think the last trip you pair did together was up to Lightning Ridge, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was absolutely fabulous. We ended up with so many different looks.
Yeah.
We went with Cara Murphy.
Yep.
And again, it was, you know, we were working in the extreme conditions. You know, we would come back to the air condition, put makeup on, get the set, start the car up, get the air conditioning, go, and we would shoot for about 10, 15 minutes. And after that, you know, makeup was running and just totally fatigued.
Yeah, right.
But she was a real Trojan. We would work early in the morning and we would do 5 or 6 different looks. And then
breakfast.
Yeah, I wish. But look, we even after we shot in the main street of Lightning Ridge on a Sunday night at 11 o'clock, and we had the police do the rounds and ask us what we were doing. So, you know, I was a bit proactive. I just walked up with the senior sergeant and said, any chance of getting you a sidekick in one of these photos? With that, he goes, yep, go on, son. Get in there. And, so we've got the New South Wales police force in a couple of the photos there. They were good blokes. But, you know, I mean, the townspeople, a small place like that, we went to the club for dinner and everybody was talking about it. They said, oh, Facebook's going crazy. There's these photographers up here taking photos. You know, you go into these places, you've only got 3 days, and you go for a drive around and you go, yep, there, let's go, let's do it. And I find it's just fantastic. And there's so many other places coming through South Australia. It's another place I want to revisit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think a lot of filmmakers know that as well. So that would be my dream, from most probably Broken Hill, going down through to Port Augusta. There's so much fertile territory there for both landscapers and editorial type, you know, type shots.
Yeah, a couple of weekends ago, we got together for some drinks up at Newcastle, and I was mentioning to Doug at the time that, you know, Kath and Max and I did a road trip to Western Australia, you know, Christmas 2012, and one of the things that I really noticed about South Australia, and I don't know if this appeals to you, Doug, but I was the amount of old sandstone ruins that just seemed to be everywhere.
Oh, keep that quiet. Yeah.
It was just awesome.
That's what stood out with me.
Yeah, and, right.
And there's quite a few little towns like that. You know, when I go into these towns, I'll always go up a side street and go round, and the locals will come out and have a look, you know, but you often find, you know, some unique places, and you put that in the back of your head for next time.
Yeah.
Or you talk to the visitors bureau or some of the locals, sit down and have a coffee and just have a chin wag, and you know, they'll open up. So long as you're ready to have a bit of time and have a listen to their story and find out about their town, they just want to share and tell you all the good bits. And there are so many places there, and you're right, I think it's so fertile.
Yeah.
But the logistics of getting a crew there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's a problem. So that's most probably one of my next ventures. So you're quite welcome to come along, Bruce.
Oh, mate, I'd love to. Unfortunately, 2017 is already well and truly planned as far as my travel goes. The wife and I are going to Europe for 5 weeks in June and July. So.
Oh, happy days.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to that. So, but it's interesting, you know, what you were saying just a minute ago about you go into these little places, and as long as you're prepared to sit down and have a listen to what they want to talk about, yeah, that is such a recurring theme. You know, the more people we talk to, the more we hear the same thing. You know, you spend some time talking to people and you get them to open up, and it's the easiest icebreaker there is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I've been known to have a bit of a chin wag. See, I come from a long line. My mother, her sister, and my grandmother both went to Melbourne Olympic Games in the sport of talking, and I believe that they were podium finishers. So, and my dad's profoundly deaf, and now I know why.
But, and thankful for it.
Absolutely. That's why they get on so well now.
Nice. Excellent. Hey, Doug, where can people see your work online?
Okay, I do have a webpage. Yep. It's www.pixelsculturesoneword.com.au.
Nice. I will put that link in the show notes for anyone that wants to check out some of Doug's photography. Are you on Flickr or any, you know, 500px or anything like that?
I am on 500px, but, you know, I'm one of these lazy guys that I'll give it a run for a couple of months and then I'll go to Tumblr or Facebook is most probably, look, it serves
its purpose. It's where the people are, right?
Yeah, look, it is. So, and I tend to showcase work that I otherwise wouldn't put on my webpage as well. So,
oh, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think a webpage is to showcase your very best.
Yep.
And I think, you know, if I do a shoot, I might whack one or two or three images up from that shoot, no more.
Right.
I'm one of these shooters. If I do one look, there's a good chance you might only get one or two photos from it. I just can't see the point in presenting 27 photos, and the only thing the model's doing is lifting a chin or one eye's closed more than the other. Or,
fair enough.
But it's still much the same. I think the viewers, we get bombarded with images. So I think it's very important to put your best foot forward, and usually one image is what does it for me.
That's a great point of view that I had never considered, and I have certainly been guilty of what you just mentioned. You know, I'll come home and process, you know, or look through the 100-odd images that I took and probably end up picking 15 to 20 that I like and then chucking them all on my website. Maybe your approach is a much better idea. Give them less and leave them hanging.
Yeah, well, look, you know, another good photographer friend of mine, we were discussing it, Simon Whitaker from Coffs Harbour.
Yeah.
We were talking about it, and when we looked at some of the really good photographers, it's exactly what they do. And when I was over in Perth, I had the opportunity to shoot a young up-and-coming 14-year-old model at the Pinnacles, just a classic day. Mum was the stylist, obviously. She travelled up with us with the makeup artist and the hairstylist.
Yep.
And on the way up, we were talking about modelling portfolios and that. And I said, the issue I have is we see models starting out and they will have done three shoots and they'll have 30 photos from each shoot and they'll call themselves experienced.
Yeah.
And we all start somewhere. So I'm not having a go at them. You've got to start somewhere. But what that portrays to the client or the photographer is that this person has not got the experience.
Yeah.
Otherwise, where is their work? And Mum said to me, she goes, I agree with you. She said, if we are only doing three looks out here at the Pinnacles, if I get three photos from this shoot, I'll be happy. And I said, great, because we're on the same page.
Yeah, I must admit, you know, there's been times where I've been looking for a model for a shoot and, you know, you're trawling through all the stuff on Model Mayhem and you see these, you know, quote-unquote portfolios that feature selfies taken in a bathroom. And it's like, wow, if you're scraping for content, you know, you could just leave that out and, you know, have one less image in your portfolio, you'd be no worse off.
Oh, look, I agree. But, you know, I suppose the point there is if they have strong images and they've got the bathroom selfie. And this is where I think Facebook is a good thing when you're looking at prospective models.
Yeah.
And you haven't seen them. To me, having a look, what do they call it? Stalking, is it? to me, I can get a good idea of the model's personality. And to me, that is one of the most important things. You can have the best looks out, but then you can't model. Or you might not be able to model for me.
Right.
I think personality, if I can see somebody's got personality and they can throw that during a shoot, then I think, wow, you're halfway there.
For sure.
So in that way, I think Facebook is great.
Yeah.
You get to see them without makeup and you get to see them clowning around or serious. And I think it's pretty important to match your models to your personality.
Yeah, right.
I really do. The best shoots I have had have been the quirky, throw a bit of cheek back, you know.
The models are as warped as you are.
Well, I hope not. I've been working on it for a lot longer than they have.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so I think that's an important thing too. And plus, a lot of the first-time models, a lot of the girls that I do shoot with are first-timers. And, you know, I might be directing them. So constant directing. And prior to the shoot, I'll most probably send them to some YouTube tutorials on how to model, how to flow,
move.
Because it must be daunting for them. I mean, you as a photographer, when somebody takes our photo or we've got a softbox looking at us, it's rather daunting. Yeah. The photographers. So some person that's never been shot before, they come into a studio and they've got this great big softbox and all of a sudden it starts flashing.
Yeah.
I mean, that must be bloody hard. So so the more insight they've got before they get there, the better they are. And I think, you know, talking to them when they get there, when their makeup's being done, you know, I think that gives a bit of an insight into their personality and you can start talking about their ideas, what they like, what they don't, what music they like. I often find, you know, putting the right music on helps and not mine. I mean, it's all right for me. I start dancing and I get a lot of blurry photos, but the models don't like my music apparently.
All right. Should we have a look at some of the stories that listeners have sent in this week?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, the first one, or the first bunch, actually, all came from Adam. Doug, I'll just let you in on the secret here. I don't even need to say his surname because the rest of the listeners know who I'm talking about. Adam's been listening to this podcast for a long, long time. So when I say that we're sent in by Adam, everyone knows that it was Adam Davidson. So this first story is about a guy who had to go shooting in the Himalayas and he needed power, which he was not going to be near AC power, for 14 days.
Wow.
And so what he did was with very little expenditure, bought a solar panel and a car charging cable that connected to his battery charger for his cameras. And with, you know, very little expenditure, he was able to set up a system that'll, you know, collected the sun's rays into the solar panel, output it as 12 volt and wired that up to the car charger plug, and was then able to charge his camera batteries on the go. I thought, what an excellent idea.
How resourceful.
Absolutely. And I think he said the car to USB adapter was less than $10, and I think the solar panel only cost him about $20 or $30. So, you know, for probably less than $50 worth of parts, he's got himself a solar-powered recharging kit. Very resourceful.
That's the word, resourceful. You know, and it comes back to the point, spending big oodles of money, and this is something that I digress, but when you post images in a competition, you can't tell whether that was made from a solar-powered, you know.
No.
Your battery's charged from there, or was this camera or that camera? We're looking at the image. I mean, I think that's fantastic. I mean, people that do that, they certainly get my vote. I mean, conversely, there was a guy that went to Mongolia.
Right.
He had the opposite. His batteries, he would only get about 2 or 3 frames before the battery was dead because of the extreme cold.
Yeah, right.
So it's working the other way. He couldn't use solar, but my goodness, the images. I mean, he's obviously thought about it, going to the Himalayas. It's, don't we get so lazy? You know, we go to places where, like Nullarbor, mind you, you see a car going past every 5 minutes and you've got an AC adapter in your car and, you know, yeah. I mean, you've got all the mod ons. So this poor bugger, yeah, he's, yeah, resourceful. That's definitely.
Definitely. The next story was about a guy who bought an old Ural truck. This is a truck that was designed for the Russian army. And he turned this truck into a camera. You kind of got to read the story to get the scale of what he did with this truck. It is unbelievable. So he raised $70,000 via a Kickstarter campaign to convert this truck into a camera, and he shoots straight onto glass plates.
Wow.
And he's shooting these, like, enormous landscape images directly onto glass plates from this truck. The video that's included in the link is definitely worth a look. So,
I'd see his tripod for that camera.
Yeah, exactly.
My goodness. Which goes to show, as photographers, we're a weird bunch. We do weird.
Yes.
I mean, who would think of that? He obviously did. I certainly wouldn't.
No, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before. You know, it's so inspiring when you see stories like this where someone has taken A, their love of photography, and B, some other random thing that they know or that is central to their life or their lifestyle, and combined the two.
So you'd want me to put a camera in my partner then?
What?
Well, you said something that was...
But I always find these stories where someone has just, you know, got this really random, what seems really random to the rest of us, but is clearly just a logical progression for them because of where their life is at. You know, they've combined their love of photography with whatever this other thing might be. And for this guy, it was wanting to shoot massive, large glass plate landscapes.
So true. you know, whatever floats your boat, but you just wonder where they get these ideas from. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Next story was Sony UK told this guy that it was not economically viable to fix his camera. So what had happened was he'd been out shooting and he'd bought a Pelican waterproof case for his camera and has got out of his kayak and was just a little bit too ambitious in opening up the Pelican case before he'd really got to dry ground. And he ends up fumbling and dropping his A7R2, one or the other, and drops it in salt water, right?
Yep.
He picks it up straight away, shakes as much water out of it as he can, and the camera still worked except for one particular button, the autofocus and auto exposure lock button. It wouldn't work.
Yep.
And so he put up with it for a long time because he got in touch with Sony in the UK. He was obviously a UK-based photographer. And they've said, nah, not economically viable to fix this camera. And so he put up with it for ages and ages and ages. And then he happened to be in Thailand and was shooting there. And it was still bugging him that this, you know, one button wouldn't work. But he then found that certain other little bits started to fail. And he figured it was all related to this previous incident. And knowing how good a reputation the Thai people have for repairing electronics, he thought, I might just contact Sony here. And so he gets in touch with Sony in Thailand, and for $120, they fixed his camera.
And a holiday.
Yes. Bonus. That's awesome. He probably felt like he finished his holiday with a new camera.
You know, there's a couple of ways you can look at that. You can say, well, in UK, the cost of labour and that most probably would have been uneconomical. I mean, we send things that are just not economical for us here in Australia to Vietnam, and their cost of labour is so cheap. They get the product and, you know, they have an army of men work on it, and next minute it's up and running. We could not do that. It's not viable. So I can understand why Sony said no, but, you know, as a consumer, you'd be going, you'd be feeling a little peeved with Sony UK. So I understand that as well.
Yep.
But, I mean, bonus for him.
Totally.
So if I ever drop my camera in the salt water, I'm just putting my lights in, I'll go for a holiday in Thailand and get it fixed.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last story that Adam sent us was all about a student who entered a photograph into a National Geographic photo competition and won, or made the finals, and that was shot with their iPhone 6.
It doesn't surprise me. You know,
pretty cool.
What I just said to you before, you put images up, and let's say if it's A4, it's going to be rather difficult to tell. I mean, they do a pretty good job, these iPhones.
All the mobile phones these days are pretty good.
My partner, Susan McNeil.
Yep.
Check her workout.
Oh, absolutely.
She was shooting with an iPhone when we met. And
right.
She was so creative. She's been now 18 months shooting and just cleaned up on some national awards, which was fabulous.
But that was only a couple of nights ago.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
And she just, for the fun of it, put an image she took with an iPhone and ended up getting, a judge's award or an honours. So,
wow.
So in club competition. So, I mean, it can be done. I mean, what they're doing with those iPhones, it goes to show it's not so much the camera. Mind you,
certainly makes a
difference.
Yeah, no, I mean we've said that on this podcast a lot too. You know, it's not the camera; it's the tool behind the camera.
Yeah, so to speak. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, that's a great photo. You must have a good camera.
Yeah, exactly. That old chestnut. When we finish recording, I will get you to send me a link to Susan's work as well, because yes, our listeners should definitely have a look at some of the stuff Susan's shooting. It's beautiful work.
When I started showing her the technical side of using a DSLR, you know, I said to her in the early stages that very shortly I hope she'll be able to teach me. She's got such a creative eye. I'll be setting up a model that I've shot many times, and she'll shoot her for the first time, and I'll leave them alone. I'll come out 20 minutes later and they're laughing and having fun, and it's like next minute I've just lost my best friend model and they're now students. So not only does she take fantastic images, she's you know, she gives them an experience. She just knows how to work a magic.
Awesome.
But anyway,
good on her. The next story we got sent was from David Kembry, and David is a bit of a Steve Parrish fan. Now, for anyone outside of Australia, the name Steve Parrish may not mean a lot, but within Australia he is a very highly known and regarded landscape and wildlife photographer.
Yes.
And this is an article that he's written on his blog about choosing a DSLR camera for nature photography. We won't go into this story. It's a good read if you're in the market for buying a camera. And he sort of goes through, you know, the different stages of cameras within, you know, the families. You know, your compacts, your bridge cameras, your entry-level SLRs, your pro SLRs, you know, your medium format stuff. So for anyone who's in the market, definitely a good read, particularly if you're into, you know, landscape and wildlife type stuff, because that is certainly where Steve Parrish has made his name.
Yeah, look, I love his landscape. And, you know, you talk about him on my last Nullarbor trip. I was perched up in my rooftop camper reading a Steve Parrish book. And
oh, is that right?
Absolutely. And I thought on the way back, something I don't do is nature, and in club competitions, I still go in the odd camera club. I don't normally enter nature, and I saw an eagle, and I thought, oh, beautiful, here's a chance.
Yep.
I've been reading my Steve Parrish book. I'm going to pull over and take this eagle.
I hope you had a long lens.
Oh, look, long enough anyway, and it took off, and I thought, you know what, I just wouldn't have the patience. Yeah. Or most probably the skill sets, how they actually sit there for hours and hours and hours just to get that one shot.
Yeah.
Wow, that's sensational.
When we crossed the Nullarbor in Christmas 2012, I was in exactly the same boat as you. You know, I kept on seeing these wedge-tailed eagles feeding on the roadkill all the way along the highway. And
that's it.
Eventually, you know, we came around a little bit of a curve, and off in the distance I could see one feeding on a dead roo on the side of the road. And so I've slowed the car down and I said, you know, I really want to get a photo of this. So I actually pulled up still half a kilometre away, jumped out, got into my camera bag, put the longest lens that I had with me onto my camera body, which I think was just a 300mm kit lens. And then just crept along the highway at about, you know, 5Ks an hour, thinking, you know, how close can I get to him without startling him? And I probably got to about 100 meters away, and he lifted off, and he flew off and landed on the branch of a, you know, one of those grey scrubby trees that litter the Nullarbor. And so I've got out of the car, and I thought I'll just keep walking towards him, but every few steps I'll stop and shoot, you know, and hopefully I can get close enough to get something decent. And he didn't let me get any closer than about 100 meters before he took off again. And I was at full zoom, got this shot, which it was nice. Like it was him in full flight and, you know, the wings outstretched and everything, but I had to crop in a long way to make something of it, you know. And I was kind of wishing I had a 500mm lens instead of a 300mm lens, because they're very paranoid animals, the wedge-tailed eagle.
They're most probably a bit like models. It's like if it was Steve Parrish, wouldn't recognize.
They'd hang around for him.
And hang around and going, not shooting with you. I don't know what I'm going to do with my photos.
That's right.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. Yeah. You know, month after month at club competitions, you see these absolute ball terror shots of eagles landing or taking prey. Or I just take my hat off to landscape photographers. It's just through their patience. I certainly couldn't do it.
Yeah. the next story we got was from Steve Peters, and this was about the cutbacks at GoPro. And this has kind of been fairly big news over the last week or two. That GoPro are letting go of, I think it was 200 members of staff. They've obviously been hit pretty hard. I mean, the recall of the Karma drone has obviously had a fairly substantial impact on the company. And it's kind of sad to see, you know, that they're doing it so hard, because GoPro really started the movement as far as these action video cameras, you know, that you can, you know, they're so tiny you can put them anywhere kind of thing, and they really made a good name for themselves. It's a shame to see that the company's fallen on such hard times.
Yeah, I mean, you often see that with technology. I mean, you know, we only have to look at mobile phones like Nokia. Where are they?
Yeah.
It seems to be Samsung you know, iPhones these days.
That's it.
So, yeah, I suppose there's always somebody waiting in the wings. You know, I suppose it's a bit of a weasel word, but innovation, the powers to be keep spruiking innovation. And I think GoPro certainly, whether they had the innovation to begin with, but they certainly knew how to market it. So,
oh, definitely. But as you say, you know, technology is always a set of moving goalposts. You know, you certainly cannot rest on your laurels in the technology sector. Not that I think GoPro did. I just think that they had their lunch eaten by all the cheap imitations.
Yes.
You know, there's so many other companies who now put out a product similar to a GoPro at a fraction of the cost. And because every man and his dog wants a part of this whole action video camera thing, and not everyone can afford, you know, the $400, $600 or whatever it requires to get into a GoPro, you know, a lot of them are going for the cheaper knockoffs. And I would say, you know, that's probably hurt the, you know, GoPro in the long run.
Yeah, you know, I love seeing the footage, but, you know, my cameras have never fired a movie shot in anger. I just haven't done it. It just doesn't interest me.
The idea of shooting video?
Yeah, the idea of shooting video. I mean, please, you're still camera and don't waste some money on the video, but that's just me personally. I like stills.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the drone, you know, when the drone images started coming out, it was like, wow, that's fantastic. Now it's a bit like HDR. Yeah. And I just wonder how soon we're going to get sick of it and we go back to just shooting so-called normal yeah. Shots. Look, I think it's great to mix it up and see different points of view and shooting different angles and things like that. But I think, like a lot of things, we, you know, the first people that get on board are the ones that really kill the pig in it, and everybody else gets sucked along. And after a while, everybody gets bored of it and we look for something new.
True.
Bring back HDR and selective colouring.
Oh, I'm not a fan of colour popping at all.
We've done it.
The next story was from Rob Coates, and this appeared on TechCrunch, and it was about the oldest surviving Nikon camera, which recently sold, wait for it, for $406,000. This camera was the third production camera that Nikon ever built. That's pretty amazing.
That is
the third camera they ever built is still around and functioning.
And
that is amazing.
406,000. You can understand. I mean, there's collectors out there. I mean, that would just be lunch money.
It's bragging rights and nothing more, isn't it?
You know, it would be nice to do that, but what could you do with that money? My goodness. And let's face it, we're not going to have brand wars here, but it's a Nikon.
Are you a Canon shooter, are you?
Look, I am, but you know, I have no allegiance to any brand, and I think most of the major marks keep leapfrogging,
yeah.
And I think Canon have been a bit lax, personally. Like a lot of people, Sony is a real option, but yeah, there's still a few things there that, you know, kept me with Canon. The fact that Canon brought the 50 megapixel out was a winner for me.
Yeah, right. I'm pretty hot under the collar right now for the new Sony, the A99 Mark II,
absolutely.
Which I think is it 48 megapixel? I think.
Yeah, but the quality of the sensor, they just, why Canon don't, you know, jump on the bandwagon, you know, better dynamic range.
Well, the thing is that Sony sell their sensors to Nikon, and there would probably be, you know, some sort of agreement, you know, between Nikon and Sony that Sony won't sell to Canon. I'm imagining, I don't know. I don't know how much control Sony would have over that. You know, would they be prepared to potentially sacrifice Nikon as a customer if they were to then sell to Canon as well? So I don't know. Don't know.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, we'll never know. But if that was me and Canon came to the party, I'd certainly jump on because that's a massive market.
Yeah.
But having said that, I mean, it's amazing what these cameras are doing these days.
Oh, for sure.
But I think I'd buy a Hasselblad or a, you know, Phase 1 before I spend $406,000 on the third Nikon. But then I have to know how to use it. And as I said, I'm just a button presser.
All right, we got a couple of stories from Carl Hemmings. The first one was all about scanning film in bulk. So this guy had somewhere between 10 and 15,000 images that he wanted to scan. And so he's put this blog post together that sort of covers all of it. You know, what equipment he needed, what software he needed, and I'll leave it to anyone who's interested in diving into that to go and read it. The link will be in the show notes. And the other one from Carl was why I switched from Nikon to Sony. And this was written by Matt Kloskowski on the B&H website. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I will be having a read of this one, Carl, so thank you for that link. Were you going to say something there, Doug?
Oh, yeah, look, I mean, from Nikon to Sony, I mean, I think most people were contemplating when they brought out the A7 R2, had the megapixels, had the dynamic range, was small.
No anti-aliasing filter.
Yeah, it had a lot of good things happening. The problem, like I've got a mate up the road here, Ian Pallett. He jumped ship from Canon to the Sony.
Right.
And thought the camera was pretty good, had a few issues, and couldn't get backup, could not get service. Nikon contacted him, and he said he couldn't be happier. Their service, so professional, fantastic.
So hang on, so he jumped from Canon to Sony and then from Sony to Nikon?
Correct.
Wow.
Yep. You know, that's over a period of time, but from the time that he got the Sony, that was only a short period of time before he got rid of it, could not get service. So, look, and I'm sure that there would be a story, you know, the other way around too, you know. I mean, we only tend to hear the bad stories. But
yeah, that's true. That's true.
But I must admit, I know most people that I was talking to would have been seriously considering jumping to the Sony. But, you know, when you invest in so much glass.
That's the killer.
That is. Although Sony have mounts. But, you know, the thing that gets me with going to a small mirrorless for studio work is the ergonomics, the balance of the camera.
Right.
I don't know whether people pay much attention. They just look at this small camera. And for street photography, fantastic. But I think in the studio, I like the feel of the bigger camera
full body.
And and the balance that it gives.
Yeah, right.
And I think when you look at the length of the Sony, say with the equivalent 70 to 200 against my camera with the 70-200, there wouldn't be much in it.
No.
But the weight would be completely different.
Yeah, right.
The ergonomics. So
yeah, with a mirrorless, you'd be much more front heavy, wouldn't you? Like with certainly with a big lens like a 70 to 200.
Yep, correct.
Yeah.
So and it comes down to what really suits you as a photographer, because we're all different.
Yeah. Well, I was saying that the other week when we were up having drinks. I can't remember the guy's name.
I think you're saying it to Richard, because we all know that Richard's different. I just thought I'd get that in.
Have a dig at him while you can.
Absolutely.
And he has no opportunity to respond. But no, I remember making the comment that, you know, it's not just about, you know, what's the most expensive camera. You know, what's best is what feels right in your hand, you know, and if the menus are laid out in a fashion that makes sense to the way you think. And, you know, there's so much more to it than just, you know, what's the most expensive, or, you know, just because 50,000 people on the internet say it's the best thing doesn't necessarily mean it's the best thing for you personally.
Correct.
And I think, you know, a large part of it is making sure that whatever system you go with works for you.
Yep, because at the end of the day, once you print that image, not unless you're an absolute expert, you tell me the difference between whether it's shot with a, you know, 5D SR or the Sony.
I honestly don't believe that the most expert of experts could even pick it.
Yeah.
There are too many variables.
Yes.
Yeah, you've got lens, you've got camera, you've got, you know, what software it was processed in, and you've then got what, you know, display medium. Is it being displayed digitally? If so, then the monitor has an impact. If it's displayed on paper, then it's the style of the paper and the type of the press. Yeah, there's so many variables. I honestly don't believe anyone could look at an image and go, oh, that was shot with a D810.
Correct. I totally agree, and you see it all the time. But we get caught up because it's the thing that we buy and we cherish, and we go to it sleeps with us, and you know, becomes part of us.
Definitely,
other people don't see that. At the end of the day, it's all about the image. You know, it's not world peace. We're taking photos for Christ's sake.
That's right.
That's for enjoyment, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, it should be. Yeah. Well, Doug, mate, thank you so much for co-hosting with me this week.
It's been an absolute blast. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Mate, no worries. So your website is pixelsculptures.com.au?
Correct.
And people can probably find you on Facebook. Doug is certainly amongst my friends, so anyone who wants to find his Facebook profile, you can certainly look amongst my friend list and find him and hit him up with a friend request if you want to.
Absolutely. Need friends, Bruce.
So
I need friends.
Yeah, you're such an introverted guy. You know, you must be really scraping to find some people to hang out with. Mate, it's been great having you on board, so thank you very much.
Thanks, Bruce.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, I suppose we should go to David Marlin's book review. Off you go, David.
Thanks, Bruce. How's this for a life? You're born in Glebe, you talk your way into participating in Mawson's 1911 expedition, and you go, despite your mother writing to Mawson himself saying, "My son has an internal complaint, has never roughed it, and has had lung trouble." You get home in 1913. Mawson, by the way, is left in Antarctica in that famous expedition. So you slip up the Java and back during winter, then join the expedition back to Antarctica to rescue Mawson. As soon as you get back, travel on a Sydney to the Gulf of Carpentaria to Sydney car journey with Francis Birtles, 6,000 miles. Then turn around and back to Antarctica with the Shackleton expedition, the famous endurance expedition. During that time, you've taken a lot of photos and you actually had to smash 400 of your negatives. You've kept 150. You get back home in 1916, and then in 1917 you get to England, but then you take a quick trip to South Georgia and back, down the Atlantic and back. Back in England in 1917, you become an official war photographer with Hubert Wilkins and Charles Bean in northern France. And you go to Ypres, Hill 60, Menin Road, Polygon Wood, Passchendaele Jail, Egypt, Rafa. You take photos of the Light Horse. You fly with Ross Smith over Beersheba and then return home. Then when Ross and Keith Smith fly on their historic flight from England to Australia, you fly on the last leg with them from Darwin back to Sydney. Then it's off to New Guinea again, back to Sydney. New Guinea again, back to Sydney. Then by the end of the 1920s, you're down in Antarctica with Mawson and his discovery expedition. During the 30s, you film some major Australian movies such as Strike Me Lucky, On Our Selection, The Squatter's Daughter. Then it's off to the Second World War. And mainly you spend your time in the Middle East, Greece, Tobruk, Syria, Lebanon, El Alamein. This, in a nutshell, is the life of Frank Hurley, an Australian photographer who is very much a household name. It's quite a remarkable story, and in many of his adventures, the expedition depended on his stills and his films to put up a good showing when they returned home to sell, to make some money for the expedition. And to be honest, Frank did take some iconic photographs, the sinking of the Endurance. His photo of Mawson has appeared on Our Currency. There is some of his war photos like the Dawn at Passchendaele. His life wasn't without risk. There's a photo of him perched precariously in the bow chains, photographing the Aurora breaking through ice. There was frontline photography in both wars, and in fact one battle in World War I. He was in a balloon while aircraft and guns were firing all around him, taking photographs. His photographs at the time were not without some controversy. Particularly during the war, his photo murals, composite photographs, were criticised at home, but they were praised abroad as trying to depict a complete picture of a battle with artillery, planes and men going over the top in one scene. He had a tendency to start the next job before finishing the last, which also caused headaches for those he worked with. So he'd be heading off to Java instead of finishing off the films to generate the money for the Antarctic expedition to break even. Any way you look at it, Frank Hurley's life was pretty remarkable. Frank Hurley, A Photographer's Life by Alastair McGregor, is published by Viking. It's a rollicking read. The hardback's unavailable, but a paperback edition is available from between $36 and $60, according to Booko. There's a couple of outrageous prices in the list, in the multiple hundreds, but you want to really enjoy your read, not pay for it that much. Cheers.
Thank you, David. Wow, what an interesting life that guy had. I was not familiar with his name, but you've intrigued me. thank you. All right, well, I think that does it for another week. Glenn is back from Myanmar next week, so we're looking forward to hearing from him. And until then, take care.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
Another audio2.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.